people used to be afraid of me, you know, because when I was really in my manic times, you know, I was a fucking dangerous thug, man, you know, because I was this scared little boy that just had to lash out at the world, you know. And so a lot of people feared me. I was a scary cat, I guess, in that incarnation. People don't react to me that way anymore. You know, I'm pretty much welcome everywhere I go. People like to see me. People come up to me and say, you helped me so much. You know, you're such a generous guy. I don't see it in myself.
So, Jonathan Shaw, you've been here before.
Yep.
And we were going to do a talk, which I think maybe we'll do today, about Brazil, which you just came back from.
Yeah, I just...
You spent how much of your time in Brazil?
Well, I spent about half my time there all my life. So I've been there on and off for about 53 years. I immigrated to Brazil when I was about 20 years old. I jumped ship. I was working on a freighter. And I jumped ship in the north of Brazil at the mouth of the Amazon. And didn't have a passport, didn't have any money. I just fucked off into the Amazon. And eventually, over the course of a couple of years, I hitchhiked and made my way all the way through Brazil to the south, to Rio de Janeiro. And just, you know, I was just a hobo, really. You know, I'd been hitchhiking all through Mexico and Central America, got work on a ship, and then ended up in Brazil at the mouth of the Amazon, jumped ship there, got involved with some crazy hookers in the north of Brazil, and just decided, well, this is as good a place as any to sort of hang my hat.
which leads to the book that you've written called Narcissa?
Well, yeah, many, many years later, decades later, after I got sober and sort of, you know, plucked my head out of my ass a little bit for a peek around. I was living in Rio de Janeiro, sort of my adopted hometown, and I got involved with a paranormal hooker and crackhead. She was not your average crackhead, I don't think. This woman, well, she was just a girl back then. She was carrying otherworldly wisdom. And every time she was smoking crack, she was channeling all kinds of entities of, you know, not of this world. And I was just so fascinated. You know, I was also, you know, hopelessly strung out on her crack, and so I was sober at the time. I was several years sober, you know, and
because you have a history with drugs.
Oh, I have a long, dark history with drugs.
But you were clean at this
that's,
time.
That's another story. Basically, I'd given up my illustrious career as a celebrity tattoo artist in New York City and moved, you know, I got sober and I was like, okay, this is it. Everything's got to change. And I got rid of everything and I moved back to Brazil and I just basically got a little space there and just started vomiting my life story onto the pages. And I'd always wanted to be a writer ever since I hung out with Bukowski in the 70s. But, you know, I could never really come up with the honesty and even the history of having lived an interesting life to, you know, put that any kind of storyline together. But when I got sober, you know, I was attempting to live a, you know, something of a spiritual life. And I got involved with shamanism, got involved with witch doctors and, you know, working with ayahuasca ceremonies and Umbanda and, you know, Brazilian spiritist doctrines. And I got very, you know, into a sort of other dimensional study. And in that, how can I say, you know, I was still this crazed, drug-addled, tortured soul, but I was seeking a path of redemption through spirituality and something, you know, through a lot of prayer and meditation and ceremonies and spirit work and stuff, some weird portal just opened up in my consciousness and suddenly I was gifted with the power to really start vomiting my life story, and everything around me just became sort of grist for the mill, so to speak, you know, and I just started writing incessantly. And all I did was basically eat, sleep, and write. And I wrote and I wrote and I wrote and wrote. And some of this stuff, I was writing my memoir. And at some point, this young crack smoking hooker came into my life, and it took me off into another direction. And I started studying the paranormal through the vessel that she was, as she was smoking crack, and just, you know, it was like this crazy Amazonian little parrot just that never shut up and was. But there was like entities speaking through her. I mean, really paranormal shit was going on. And I was so fascinated and obsessed with, you know, this thing that just dropped into my life that I stopped writing about me and my journey and all my, you know, crazy drug-fueled adventures and, you know, traveling the world, you know, as a hobo. And I just became obsessed with this being that was, you know, in my life. So I started to just listen to her and take notes and write and write and write. And I wrote everything, you know, I wrote her whole life story, you know, everything, but also all these entities that would come and speak through her, you know, like alien things. And I'm just taking notes. And that wound up turning into this big old pile of notes that I never really thought I was writing a book. I mean, I was writing my book, which, you know, became my memoir, which years later actually was published as Scab Vendor Confessions of a Tattoo Artist, that went on to inspire a fucking movie with, you know, big name people in it like Johnny Depp and Iggy Pop and Jim Jarmusch and lots of other really interesting people, and people in the tattoo world, and just people. You know, it's a pretty good movie they made about me, inspired by this book.
It's a documentary about your
life. It's a documentary about my life and travels and times and, you know, failures.
But Narcissa is more.
But Narcissa was like this channel that just, while I was writing the first book, Narcissa came into my life, the person that I call Narcissa. And she inspired me to just start writing all this other stuff. So I wrote this. I wrote pages and pages and pages of this stuff. I wasn't thinking of ever like this was going to be a real novel that would be published someday. I never thought of it like that. It was just kind of like this deep study. And of course, you know, being a drug addict myself, I was deeply identifying with this person and her pathology, and I could relate it to my own. So I was writing about her, but I was also writing about my own, you know, twisted shit, you know, because I could see a lot of my own shit reflected in her. So she became like this weird, surreal kind of funhouse mirror for me. And I'm writing all this stuff, and I'm just writing, taking notes. And, you know, we had some wild adventures. I mean, I'm, you know, traveling around, you know, the slums of Rio de Janeiro on a motorcycle with her hanging on the back, and we're rioting through, you know, gunfights and apocalyptic shit, and, you know, to get her drugs. And, you know, there was a lot of adventures in that relationship. And what happened was one day some writer from the States sent me an email. He was a guy that I sort of knew people in common with, a pretty good writer. And he'd sent me an email saying, "Hey, JS, I'm just about to publish a new book, and I'd love it if I could get an endorsement from you or a blurb for my new book." And I'm like, "Sure, you know, I'll always do anything for anybody, you know, if they're trying to do something cool." So, you know, I was like, "Yeah, absolutely, sure. Send me some pages, and I'll give it a read, and I'll write something nice, and you can put it on the back cover, whatever you do with that." So he sent me this stuff, and I read it, and it was good, and I wrote something nice, and I sent it back to him, and he was like, so then we struck up a conversation, And he was like, so what have you been doing? I was like, I've been doing a little bit of writing myself, you know. And we started talking about that whole process. And he was like, oh, really, you're writing? What kind of stuff are you writing? And I don't know, just some weird notes about this weird relationship I found myself in. And he was like, oh, could I see some of it? And I was like, well, I really haven't shown this stuff to anybody, but sure. You're a fellow writer, you know, and he's also a guy, recovering alcoholic addict, you know, sober guy. So I was like, yeah, sure, man, you know, maybe you can help me make some sense out of this shit, you know. So I sent him a few of the pages, just some weird stories that I'd written, you know, in this relationship. And he read it and he was like, man, this shit's really good. Would it be okay if I showed it to my publisher? And I was like, publisher? Sure, why not? I'm not thinking anything's going to come of this. Next day, I get a call from this guy who's also like this kind of rock and roll publisher, and he's the guy that he'd shown it to, and he was like, this stuff's incredible. You got any more? And I was like, yeah, I got a whole bunch of this stuff, you know? I mean, he's like, do you think you could give it to us to publish as a book? You have enough to fill a reasonable sized book? And I was like, oh yeah, there's hundreds of pages of this, you know? And he was like, well, I want to publish this stuff. It's so raw. It's so crazy. It's so dark. It's fucked up. You know, this is what I specialize in. He had a sort of a cult classic kind of indie publishing house that basically catered to like punk rock, kind of all underground, you know, Bukowski type. So that was his, you know, his hang, you know. And it was a small thing, but very respected amongst like a certain segment of like artsy people. So I was like, yeah, sure. So he pressured me to just put this together, weave it into some kind of a book. And I was like, this isn't really ready to be published. I mean, I'm a writer. I want to see stuff that's actually got like a beginning, a middle, and end. This is just some random weirdness. And he was like, no, I want to publish it just like that. And I was like, okay. So he took all this stuff and I did a little bit of editing and tried to weave it into something somewhat coherent. And I gave it to him way before I would have normally wanted to give it to somebody that's going to show it to, you know, like the world. Because I thought it was, you know, pretty incoherent. But he seemed to really like it. So I gave him this raw material and he published it as a book called Narcissa, Our Lady of Ashes. And weirdly enough, the book became like this big-ass cult classic. I mean, not big like bestseller big, but big, you know, people were talking about it, you know. And then Johnny Depp got a hold of it, and he read it, and he fell in love with the book. And he was like, you know, Johnny's, you know, he's an old friend of mine, you know, kind of like a kindred spirit in a weird way. I mean, he's like way famous. I'm not. But, you know, we have a lot in common, and he's always kind of like seen me as kind of this weird role model in some ways. You know, people come up to me in random places and go like, you remind me of Johnny Depp, you know, and I'm like, nah, man, Johnny Depp reminds you of me, but you don't know who I am. It's a funny thing. But anyway, so he read the book, and you know what I'm getting to with that, the fact that he's kind of used me as a role model, that he read the book, and later on he went and lived it when he married that fucking whore, that Amber Heard person. He married basically the dark side of Narcissa, the real Narcissa, who inspired this book. It was actually a pretty nice person. She was just really fucked up. Amber Heard is just, as far as I can tell, is just a straight up evil sociopath, you know, with just no conscience whatsoever. As far as I could see, that's what he married. But he married this woman that was just tore his life to fucking smithereens. And that's kind of what this book is about. And after all that was said and done, and he divorced her, and they, you know, had the trial, and he won, and everything was, you know, over, you know, I was sitting with him maybe a couple of years ago, and I said to him, you know, I wrote that book kind of like as a warning, not as a, you know, how to do manual, you know, because he actually read that book and then he wound up going and living it in the most twisted, way. So anyway, the book. So the book was, you know, it came out on this indie publisher. People liked it. Next thing you know, he asked me if he could republish it, and they published it with HarperCollins. HarperCollins gave him a celebrity imprint with that big-ass publishing company, and it was the first or second book that he published while he had that imprint. So it got out on HarperCollins. It got into, like, mainstream bookstores all over the, you know, all over the place. Like, you know, you go to Barnes & Noble and it would be there on the shelf, you know, this nasty, dirty, demented, just book that just oozes depravity from every page, man. You know, it's a book that would make my old friend Bukowski cringe, you know. It's dark because it's about the pathology of these trauma bond relationships, but it's not like a scholarly text about that stuff. It's like, this is what it looks like. This is what it feels like. This is what it smells like. This is how much it hurts. You know, this book was written with tears and blood and sperm and suffering, you know, because that's what drug addiction and sex addiction and all any kind of addictive pathology, you know, is all about. So, you know, the book got out there and, you know, at some point that relationship went its course and I just went back to writing my memoirs. And that's pretty much, you know.
How many years did that relationship last?
Well, you know, it's kind of not over because she wound up getting sober. And now we're pals, you know. She lives somewhere in Europe. She I mean, this was like the most demented, you know, gutter slithering rat soul that ever existed. I mean, this was a fucking, you know, a vermin.
And what is it that attracted you to her?
I think the frequency of the insanity, because see, I know where my addiction sort of was spawned as a child. I grew up with an alcoholic mother. Go figure, you know, like if it ain't one thing, it's the fucking mother, you know. So, you know, I have this trauma bond with somebody and she, you know, she basically shapeshifted. I saw it when she'd be smoking crack and then suddenly she'd shapeshift into my whatever entity possessed my poor, deranged alcoholic mother. Because I grew up with a violent, crazy, you know, schizophrenic alcoholic mother who, you know, perpetrated a lot of violence and emotional and physical abuse when I was a kid. So, you know, being sober and being attached to a spiritual sort of recovery-based study, I wound up, of course, attracting to me the exact root of my own traumas so that I guess I could relive it as a sovereign adult human being and thereby find some sort of closure and healing to my own twisted shit. So it was all for a good purpose, man, you know? I mean, basically there's that little lost child that you know, is watching mommy tear the world to shreds and not understanding. And immediately the first thought that comes to the child is, well, there must be something wrong with me because mommy, who's supposed to love me, isn't acting right. So I must have done something wrong. There must be something broken in me. It's my fault. You know, the infantile ego is just going to be the center of the universe, whether for good or for worse. But, you know, so that created that sort of self-loathing, self-destructive pathology in myself. Like, my mother is acting like a fucking lunatic. It's my fault. So I have to heal mommy. So all these decades later, as a sober dude, you know, in a spiritual quest, I wound up attracting this entity through this, you know, beautiful, raging, crazy, passionate woman that represented the mother wound in myself. And that's what the book, basically the moral of the story. Because when Johnny Depp said he was going to republish the book with HarperCollins, I was like, oh shit, I better clean this fucking book up. Not as far as making it family friendly, but clean it up literarily. So I went, you know, and I moved to Paraguay, rented a little room in Asuncion, away from everybody and everything. And I just sat and I spent like 6 months going through the original book and editing it to make it just more coherent. It's still a dirty, demented, crazy, filthy, nasty book. But I cleaned it up in the sense that now it had chapters, now it had protagonists, you know, I made it respectable into a novel. And it came out as a really good novel, you know, it's a lot of people, you know, have read this and been like, this is, you know, I mean, the comments that I've gotten from like better writers than myself that are praising this book, you know, something came through me and allowed me to, you know, put this thing into some sort of order. So the book became like, you know, kind of like a classic text on just addiction and I don't know, you know, it took on a life of its own. And I remember when we were talking like last year and you'd just gone through your own crazy trauma bond situation that was pretty fucking devastating and dramatic. And believe me, I know from devastating and dramatic, you know, I've been there. And, you know, I identified right away with your, you know, your pain and your suffering and your confusion and your all that, you know, just that.
Yeah, you and I met.
Because I.
Right after it happened.
Right after it happened.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you were like, you know, just like, fuck it. I'm just going to keep working. I'm just going to keep going.
I wasn't sleeping. I know that.
No, you weren't sleeping. You were, you know, you're doing what you do. You were doing God's work. You were working around the fucking clock and just keeping that engine on the tracks, man, you know. And I so admired that because that's kind of what I've had to do. You know, I've walked through the fucking depths of fucking hell and just kept going somehow. Because if I stopped for a minute to contemplate my circumstance, I'd probably blow my fucking brains out. So I you know, identified with your, you know, your situation. And then, you know, at that point I said, well, you know, I've been there, done that, and then some, and I feel you, brother. And then I told you about my book. And you know, we sat down and I read you just the introduction. Just the introduction was written.
Can you read that again?
Yeah, I'll read it for you, you know, because it might even, you know, take on even, you know, new meaning for you now that, you know, sort of the dust has settled a little bit.
Yeah,
you know,
the dust has settled a lot.
Yeah, so.
It's been a lot has changed in the last year.
Of course. Because you had to walk through that fire to get to, you know, a good place. There's no way of stepping around these potholes in life, man. That's what, you know, whatever little bit of wisdom I've been granted, you know, tells me that, you know, there's just no way of stepping around it. You got to go right through the fucking shit to come out the other side and, you know, maybe clean up a little bit, you know, once you get out of
it. The intro to Narcissa sells the whole book.
This is the introduction, yeah. And this introduction is the only part of the book that I didn't write. This whole book is written by me, but the introduction was written by a fellow writer who, you know, some people might know, named Lydia Lunch. She's kind of like a punk rock icon. She wrote a bunch of books herself. She's a great writer. And, you know, we became friends through mutual respect and as writers. And she read this book and she was like, holy shit, this is like hardcore. And I was like, wow, you really liked it? And she's like it. This is like the best thing I ever read. I was like, well, I'm honored. Would you do me the honor of writing an introduction to it? She was like, fuck yeah. You know, so she wrote this introduction to the book. And this, you know, this kind of sums up, you know, in theory, not in actual detail, but it sums up in theory the sort of like the underlying theme of the book, if you will. So here it is. This is the introduction by Lydia Lunch. You can't save anyone from themselves. You will lose everything by attempting to play savior. You will never heal the wounded. You cannot repair the damage already done by selfish parents, vicious ex-lovers, child molesters, tyrants, poverty, depression, or simple chemical imbalance. You can't undo psychic wounds, bandage old scars, kiss away ancient bruises. You can't make the pain go away. You can't shut down the voices in other people's heads. You can't make anyone feel special. They will never feel beautiful enough, no matter how beautiful they are to you. They will never feel loved enough, no matter how much you adore them. You will never be able to save the battered from battling back at a world they've grown to hate. They will always find a way to pick up where the bullies have left off. They will, in turn, become bullies. They will turn you into the enemy. They will always find a new method in which to punish themselves, thereby punishing you. No matter how much you've convinced yourself that you've done absolutely everything in your power to prove your undying devotion, unfaltering commitment, and unending encouragement, you will never be able to save a miserable bastard from themselves. The wounded will always find a way to spread their pain over a vast terrain, like an emotional tsunami that devastates the surrounding terrain, an ever-expanding firewall that will singe everything and everyone in its wake. The longer you love a damaged person, the more it will hurt you. They will mock your generosity, abuse your kindness, expect your forgiveness, try your patience, sap your energy, and eventually murder your soul. You will not be happy until you are as miserable as they are. Then their incredible self-loathing will be justified by the perpetuation of a cycle from which there is little recourse. Once you enter their free fall, it will be virtually impossible to turn your back on them. You will be racked with guilt, frustrated by your own impotence, and made furious for ever buying into their shit in the first place. Of course, the more damaged, the more charismatic, the more brilliant, the more sexually intoxicating, the more dangerous to your own mental health. Love is a battlefield, a landmine, a slaughterhouse, a refugee camp, a whorehouse, an insane asylum, a prison, a purgatory of abusive repetition rippling off into infinity, a twisted funhouse mirror that mimics Dante's nine circles of hell, a place where the lonely souls of the eternally damned dance a wicked dervish steeped in the desperation of those determined to throw themselves deep into the pit of a flaming volcano, seeking a baptism of fire, in search of paradise, nirvana, heaven, a return to the garden from which they have and always will be banished. Jonathan Shaw's Narcissa, Our Lady of Ashes, is a heartbreaking tome of diseased lust that oozes a tortured poetry of bloody sweat and sperm, a grotesquely beautiful love song steeped in the perpetual twilight horror of an unbearable trauma bond, an odyssey in which the twin furies of addiction and codependency bitch-slap you with a big dick whose own insatiable hunger attempts to feast again and again. And in return, it feeds back to the victim-turned-victimizer, a mad love, an overwhelming sex magic magnet to the darkest forces of our own primordial essence. Narcissa is mandatory reading for anyone who has ever been fucked up, fucked over, or fucked with to their very core in a fit of possession. Anyone who's been blindsided by love and lust and shackled by passion to a low-life, scum-sucking, junkie vampire whose devastating beauty and raw animal magnetism painted them as dark angel and ancient mystic. A purifying, fire-breathing, flesh-eating demon whose warpath and wrath against the world and everything in it, by some twisted kink in our own psyche, became the tortured path we willingly spiraled into in search of our own redemption, in the desperate hope of saving our mirrored reflection from the bottomless pit of love's eternal negation.
Wow.
Yeah. So that's her poetic, you know, summary of all the demented shit contained in those pages.
What did you learn from that period of your life and all the other things you've been through? Because you've been sober now for how long?
I've been sober. I just celebrated 25 years sober. What did I learn? What does one learn on, you know, such a journey? That's That's a big fucking question,
what,
man.
Yeah, I know it is. What?
I think it's. I don't think you can quantify it. I think it's kind of like. I can't look in the mirror and see any progress that I've made spiritually, emotionally, mentally, physically. You know, as somebody seeking recovery from mental illness and spiritual malady. But what I can tell you is my life's a lot more stable today. So, well, you know,
that's what you learned. You don't really learn it
in a way where you could say, I learned this, I learned that. It's more like it's a cathartic thing that just kind of takes possession of your life, you know, and it reflects back to you through relationships, like people that I have relationships with today. You know, people used to be afraid of me, you know, because when I was really in my manic times, you know, I was a fucking dangerous thug, man, you know, because I was this scared little boy that just had to lash out at the world, you know. And so a lot of people feared me. I was a scary cat, I guess, in that incarnation. People don't react to me that way anymore. You know, I'm pretty much welcome everywhere I go. People like to see me. People come up to me and say, you helped me so much. You know, you're such a generous guy. I don't see it in myself. I really don't. But, you know, the reflection comes back, you know, and I'm like, wow, you know, I must have done something right all these years just by staying sober and attempting to stay on the path. Because, you know, sobriety is just I mean, it's interesting because, you know, I want to say that since I started bringing people to you that were actually sober junkies and sober alcoholics, mm-hmm. you know, I've watched your channel sort of take a you know, a turn.
I've done a lot more recovery stories.
A lot more recovery stories, which, bro, that brings tears to my eyes, man, because, you know, because I've been watching your stuff for years and years. You know, I travel cross country endlessly by car. I just sit in this car and, you know, just eat up the road and east to west, north to south. You know, I put on 30,000 miles a year in this old car of mine, you know, just traveling from town to town and shop to shop. You know, it's that old gypsy blood that my mother gave me, you know. And you know, while I'm traveling like that, I'm listening to all these stories, you know. So before I ever met you, I already knew a lot of these people that you brought in, with these horrendous stories, and most of them are people that are going to die in the gutter, you know. Most of them are going to die an ass bleeding, tortured, slow, demented death in the fucking gutter, talking to the fucking pigeons. And you know, and when I met you, you know, we did our thing, and then I was like, hey, you know, I'm a recovered addict, you know. Maybe I know a bunch of other guys like me, you know, who recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. Would you be interested in talking to some sober guys, you know, who've been there in the gutter and on Skid Row and in, you know, prison and all the rest of it? And you were like, yeah. And since then, you know, you've started to accumulate, you know, a community of these kind of people that are also telling their stories.
Yeah, I like sprinkling in some of the recovery stories too.
Well, yeah, because
it just got too dark to never do that.
No,
but I have the same fascination I think you had with,
of course,
this woman in Brazil, these people on the street.
Of course,
because they're just fascinating.
Fascinating. I mean, there's nothing.
Who the hell would live a life like that?
It's extreme, man. It's extreme. And, you know, when you get right down to the roots of it, the causes and conditions, you know, it's just, it's a testament to the nobility of the human soul that people could endure such torturous situations. I mean, fucking child rape, whatever you want to, you know, all that. Just physical abuse, torture, you name it. And turn out to be people that actually have this inner strength and nobility to them, you know, especially the ones who are recovering, but even the ones who haven't found recovery yet, you know, I see the beauty of their soul that they could endure such, you know, such torment and still be living with maybe a little glimmer of hope that maybe someday, some way, you know, there's a rainbow at the end of the fucking tunnel, you know?
That's what you learned.
Yeah.
When I asked you earlier, what did you learn? That's what you learned.
Well, I learned it through personal, you know, suffering and redemption. But I also belong to communities today of people who are on this path, you know? And it's the most authentic, most honest, most generous people I've ever known. I mean, I just was 8 months in Brazil, and I was among these people, you know, in shamanic circles with the ayahuasca and also in 12-step recovery communities. And, you know, I just love these people, man, because it's my people, you know. I don't, I walk into a room of recovering alcoholics and addicts, and, you know, I might not know anybody, but I know I'm with the fucking kindred, room full of kindred souls, you know. And that's, if there's any gifts out of this whole thing, it's just that, to belong, you know, because I was an outsider all my life. I never fit in anywhere. And today I can walk into a room and feel like, hey, man, you know, I got a whole bunch of people here that get me, and I get them, and, you know, we're good.
It's a really tight community.
It's tight, and it's anarchistic as fuck. You know, there's no rules. I mean, we're all fucking rebels, defiant to the bone by nature. And at the same time, you know, we're willing to submit to some sort of spiritual discipline just to save our own fucking neck. But, you know, through that willingness, that practice, all kinds of beautiful things emerge, you know, from, you know, what is it? It's like some Buddhist saying, like, you know, without the shit, the lotus doesn't grow. The lotus, this beautiful flower, it grows from a pile of fucking sewage, man. So that's kind of where we are. And I think Carl Jung, who I like to listen to a lot, I've sent you some of those things. Carl Jung said something along the lines of, I don't even remember, man, but it comes down to that. You know, like the tree that stretches its branches highest to the heaven has its roots deeply founded in hell, you know? And that's, you know, that. So, yeah, you know, I respect and love the people who've really been through fucking hell to, you know, to come out the other side or not. But, you know.
They're just more interesting.
They're a lot more interesting. And, you know, there's a thing in this book where, you know, he's thinking to himself because he goes to some kind of party, and there's a lot of sort of square people there at the party, you know, artsy-fartsy types in some gallery, and they're all sipping their little, you know, glasses of wine, and they're all posing and posturing, and he's this fucking, you know, fucked up pirate gypsy dude, you know, ex-con, and, you know, that's my persona in this book. And he's sitting there and he's going, boring, these fucking alcoholics or whatever they are, these fucking artsy normal people are so fucking boring. Crackheads are so much more interesting. So, I mean, it's true. It's fucking true, man. So, yeah.
And you live your life now just as a free man, just going back and forth.
Yeah, thank God. Yeah.
It's a great way to live.
Well, at one point I was facing 20 years in prison when I was 10 years sober. The wreckage of my past caught up to me in New York on a brief visit. I was living in Brazil, and I came up to New York for a brief visit, and suddenly all hell broke loose, and the cops were like, he's here. And they came and busted down my door. And
for
fucking,
what?
About 100 counts of weapons charges. I had a big arsenal that was stored in a storage facility in New York City, and I didn't know that the cops had come across that and found it. And, you know, there was bombs, there was, you know, automatic weapons, there was, you know, you name it, there was grenades, there was all kinds of shit, you know. And that wound up going into the documentary, the movie that they made about me. But yeah, you know, so I was basically on trial. That trial, well, it was a legal battle. I won't call it a trial because it never went to trial, but there was a legal battle that went on for years, and they took my passports. They had me under house arrest. I couldn't travel. They took all my shit, piles of journals. They thought I was some kind of fucking terrorist, you know, because I was, you know, back in the day when I was, you know, it's kind of like the guy in New York with all the tattoo shops, illegal tattoo shops at that. You know, I was running with a, you know, pretty rough crowd, you know. I mean, a lot of my lifelong friends are, you know, mobsters and outlaw 1% bikers and stuff like that. So, you know, I was kind of known to, but they wanted me, man. You know, it was a setup of some sort because, Cyrus Vance Jr. was the prosecutor, the attorney general of New York City at the time. And, you know, that's some, you know, heavy duty reptilian type, you know, people with power. And he was like, oh, this guy, yeah, he's been on David Letterman. He's, you know, the tattooer to the stars, and he's got all these fucking weapons, you know, in a cache. Yeah, we're going to pin him as a fucking terrorist and put his ass in jail for, you know, till they throw dirt on him. And it, by the grace of God, you know, it's interesting that I skated out of that. I skated out of that, you know, because of a confluence of crazy circumstances. It turned out the judge in the case found out that I was a recovering alcoholic that belonged to the same 12-step program he'd been in for 40 years, and my lawyer just happened to let him know that I was, you know, not the same guy that collected all those weapons and, you know, didn't mind using them on any poor devil that got in my way. You know, suddenly now the judge is like this recovering alcoholic, and he's looking at all these testimonials that the lawyer had gotten from people that I'd helped as a recovering alcoholic. And she sent them all to the judge just on a whim. She just thought, oh, this might help. And then it turns out he was one of us. And he was like, all right, case dismissed. How the fuck does that happen? You know, unless you're walking, you know, the path. If you're walking the path, you know, undeserved gifts can come your way, you know. I mean, you could never have told me when I was fucking 30 years old shoving needles into my arm, when I was 20 years old shoving needles into my arm, when I was 16 year old shoving needles into my arm, you could have never told me that someday I'd be sitting here 73 years of age, 25 years sober, talking to you and sharing my experience, strength, and hope for the next poor bastard that, you know, might be like, how do I fucking get out of this fucking, you know, this shithole I've dug myself into, you know?
What role did your famous father, your father was jazz musician Artie Shaw?
Yeah, my father was a world-class famous dude. I mean, back in the 30s and 40s, right. You know, it was a different world back then, but back in the 30s and 40s, my father was as famous as Elvis, as Michael Jackson, as Mick Jagger. He was a player, too. I mean, he yes, was not right. Just a, you know, great jazz musician, but he also was like a, you know, he was a player. He married Lana Turner, Ava Gardner, you know, had affairs with Judy Garland, Billie Holiday. I mean, he was, you know, he was a hot dude, you know, and he got into every fucking thing. He was also a fucking genius. He read incessantly, read every book ever written. You know, he got to meet everybody of his age, you know, like he sat with Einstein and people like that. You know, he was best friends with all the people that mattered back in his generation, you know. I never knew the man.
You never knew him?
Well, I got to know him after I got sober. I sought him out, and he was like, hey, you're a fucking stranger. What do you want here? And I was like, I just want to know where the fuck I came from. You know, I was 48 years old, and I sought this guy out. Him and my mother couldn't get along. He was a sick dude in his own right. He wasn't an alky. He wasn't a junkie, but he was fascinated with alkies and junkies. So he married alcoholic women, and some of his best friends were hoped to die fucking dope fiends. Lenny Bruce was one of his best friends, and he was always running around behind these people trying to save them because he had his own sick savior, Narcissa kind of complex, you know. So he married my mother, who was an aspiring actress. She was a big deal, actually, when they got married. She'd been in, of all things, she'd been a supporting role in Billy Wilder's Academy Award-winning movie, The Lost Weekend. It's a story about an alcoholic writer. Go figure. You can't make this shit up that later in life I'd go on to become an alcoholic writer. You know, and my mother, you know, some beautiful, tragic, crazy alcoholic, you know, falling star.
And what is it about our attraction to these kind of people?
Well, I can't say what yours is, but I can certainly pinpoint my own because, like I said earlier, if it ain't one thing, it's the mother. You know, I had a mother that was, you know, beautiful, but I had a love-hate relationship with my mother because she was Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. She would be the kindest, most loving, most charismatic, most charming, beautiful mother figure, and then she'd turn on you like a fucking rattlesnake as soon as the fucking demon got in her. And so I grew up with that. So, you know, of course that's, you know, that's going to send me on a certain path, you know. But I didn't really even discover the depth of this pathology until I got sober and had to live through it sober. You know, I'm living with this crack whore who's like blowing crack in my face while I'm banging her, and I'm sober, man, you know. So obviously I'm, you know, the wheels are turning in my head, and I'm going, there, what's wrong with this picture? You know, what's wrong with me that, you know, this is my groove, man. You know, I mean, I said it the other day at a recovery meeting in Brazil. I said, you know, somebody said, well, you know, what's the attraction? I said, a frequência da doença, which means it's the frequency of the disease. But it's cool in Portuguese because it rhymes. A frequência da doença. It sounds so good. But it really is what I'm attracted to because of my own twisted DNA is the frequency of the disease. And I could not relate to any human being any more than I could relate to, you know, like a suffering fucking crack addict who also was like beautiful, like the most beautiful woman I ever laid eyes on, you know. So go figure.
We're all fucked up.
Well, that's okay. You know, I'm kind of okay with it today.
Yeah,
I guess that's the gift. You know, what have you learned? I've learned to be like, yeah, man, I am fucked up. And you know what? It's okay. If I wasn't fucked up, I probably wouldn't be able to help anybody else who's fucked up because I'd be some preachy, squeaky clean, you know, fucking do-gooder asshole, you know. But they know from my story and just from the way, you know, I carry my frequency that I ain't no fucking bleeding fucking deacon. I ain't no fucking saint. I'm a flawed, fucked up, tortured soul of a human being. And that's how I can be of service and help to some other poor devil. Because if I was like all nice and, you know, squeaky clean, they'd just be like, get the fuck out of here, you know?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
So I guess I can be okay. We can be okay with where we are because, you know, what are you going to do? What the fuck are you going to do? You know, maybe in the next life we'll progress a couple inches more. But for now, it's all good.
Awesome. Jonathan Shaw, thank you so much.
Thank you, Mark. You're a fucking superstar, brother.
Have a great summer here in L.A.
Yeah, man.